this is what you're fighting for. I mean, every day you're out there.
What they're doing is blowing people off.
If you continue to look the other way and shut up, then the oppressors, the authoritarians, get total control and total power. Because this is just like in Arizona, this is just like in Georgia. It's another element that backs them into a corner and shows their lies and misrepresentations.
That's why this audience is gonna have to get engaged. As we've told you, this is the fight.
All this nonsense, all this spin, they can't handle the truth.
War Room, Battleground. Here's your host, Stephen K. Bannon.
Okay, let's be blunt. There's not a bigger battleground than big tech right now. And you see this on the financial side. You see it in this, these bank failures. You're seeing it in everything. If you watch any of these committee hearings, it's one big tech working with government nonstop. You couldn't have watched the Taibbi hearings over at the weaponization and not be shocked. It's Wednesday, 15 March, year of our Lord 2023. It is the Ides of March. I want to thank all of the team that put together that great cold open today, that went through all the what happened to Caesar, what Caesar had done, and what happened to him, which I thought was quite powerful. Remember, our founding fathers' revolutionary generation was absolutely obsessed by the Roman Republic for good reasons. Our government is kind of the foundational elements is the Roman Republic. Mike Davis, you've dedicated your life to this. You know, Davis could go out and make big bucks, but he's out there hammering all the time on tech. And here's what I don't get. And look, I think very highly of Jim Jordan and the world. And that's what was so confusing about this, because he's always come across to me as a fighter. I know the audience does too. There's something not right here. And it's one of these things like the Ukraine. I can't quite figure it out, but once I figure it out, I got it. Is it because big tech's got so much cash, all the lobbyists, they put so much weight and, quite frankly, intimidate people? If you go up against them, you're not going to get a great job, particularly if you're a lawyer. You're not going to get hired by a big firm. You're going to known as having the mark of Cain on you. Is it part of it, the Chinese Communist Party, which is so infested in the Sequoia and Silicon Valley and venture capital? I'm not saying people on these committees have had influence, but there's got to be something more. I don't understand why they leaked this. Particularly, they got their conference coming up this weekend. They leaked this that they're going to not take any real action, essentially, against big tech, which this base in the Trump movement hates big tech because of what they've done to deplatform and debank them, etc. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, Jim Jordan wants to give Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Apple 2 more years of antitrust amnesty, and they will become even more powerful. They will crush even more competition. They'll shutter even more small businesses. They'll cancel even more conservatives. And the reason Jim Jordan, his excuse for doing this, is he doesn't want to give the Biden administration more resources and power. Why would say this? This is antitrust is targeted law enforcement. We have the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, and the Antitrust Division at the Justice Department. The Lina Khan, the Biden appointee at the FTC, got 69 Senate votes. That's a lot, including from people like Josh Hawley. Jonathan Cantor in the Antitrust Division got 68 votes. That's a lot, including from people like, again, Josh Hawley. These are serious antitrust reformers who want to work with a bipartisan coalition to hold big tech accountable. So I would say to Jim Jordan, if you don't want to give the Biden administration money to fight big tech, do you want to give the Biden administration money to fight fentanyl? Do you want to give the Biden administration money to beef up the border? Do you want to give the Biden administration money to fight violent crime? It's a nonsensical argument. He's doing this because he's doing big tech's big, and you have to ask why, Steve. Like you said, I mean, he's taken a lot of big tech's money.
Hang on. What does he mean by he doesn't want to give Biden more resources? Because he's afraid big tech will come in to support the campaign at 24. They'll go all in if the Republicans try to step up. Is his argument we're just going to enrich Biden and make it more difficult to remove him from office? Is that the case?
No, I mean, he's saying we shouldn't give money to the Federal Trade Commission and the Antitrust Division at the Justice Department, because that gives the Biden administration money. Well, do we stop giving money to the Biden DEA? Do we stop giving money to the Biden Border Patrol? I mean, it's really a stupid argument, and it shows that this is a shell game that Jim Jordan is playing, because he's coddling big tech, particularly Google. And you have to ask why. He's taken a lot of big tech's money over the years. So has Kevin McCarthy. Both of their top aides have taken big tech's money over the years. Kevin McCarthy's top advisor on the outside is Jeff Miller. He's a lobbyist who's taken millions of dollars from Amazon. You have Jim Jordan's top staffers on the Judiciary Committee. One of his chief counsels on the Judiciary Committee comes from that Google world. He's the one who drives this. He takes Google trips around the world. He's come from Google world. There's a revolving door between the Google funded world and the, you know, the House Judiciary Committee that Jim Jordan leads. Look, if Jim Jordan were just honest about this, if he would just come out and say, you know what, I don't think we should break up big tech because of X, but he doesn't. He says he wants to hold big tech accountable, but then he does their bidding behind the scenes, and that's the problem. Daryl Issa makes no bones about it. He's from California. He wants to protect his constituents in California. I mean, I don't agree with him, but I understand his position. I don't understand Jim Jordan's position. And what I particularly don't like about what Jim Jordan does is that he gaslights and then he undermines people like me running the Internet Accountability Project on a shoestring budget. And he wants to undermine what I'm doing because I oppose, because I'm calling out his nonsense. I'm calling out his BS on this big tech fight. And this Hill story.
What is this? Yeah.
Go ahead.
You think the Hill story is accurate?
It's 100% accurate. I've been arguing this for 3 years. I worked very closely with Congressman Ken Buck, who has been a warrior on this. I came from Senator Grassley's office, who's been a warrior on this. Look, this is a big, when I started this big tech fight 3 years ago, it was a very lonely fight taking on big tech from the right. So I am all about converts. If Jim Jordan wants to be a convert on this, I will welcome him into the fight, and I'll stop bashing him on your show and Fox News and every other conservative media outlet. I will welcome him into this fight, but he needs to have a come to Jesus. He needs to be a real convert here and stop doing Google's bidding and join the fight to hold big tech accountable.
Let's take a minute. You were very excited a couple of weeks ago about what was going to happen with Google, what was going to press forward. Is that still in the works?
Absolutely. There are two lawsuits right now from the Biden antitrust division. Jonathan Cantor is fantastic. He's pursuing the antitrust lawsuit against Google for their online search monopoly, and so that was started by the Trump administration. And he just initiated another lawsuit with the Virginia Attorney General and many other Republican AGs across the country. Andrew Ferguson, my former colleague on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and a Justice Clerk, Thomas Clerk, when I clerked for Justice Gorsuch, is teaming up with Jonathan Cantor to go after Google's online search monopoly. That is the silver bullet. If you break up their online search monopoly, they control all sides of it, buy, sell, and trade. That is where they get their lifeblood. It's the online advertising. That is what fuels big tech, particularly Google. So if you break that up, that is the silver bullet. The problem is these lawsuits take years, sometimes even decades, right? Look at the Microsoft lawsuit. Senator Mike Lee, who is a convert in this fight, he came at it with pure intentions. He was kind of a libertarian on let's not use antitrust to go after big tech, but he's seen over the last 3 years how bad big tech is and how they abuse their market power to crush competition, shutter small businesses, cancel conservatives. Mike Lee has been red-pilled. He's been great on this. There is a bill that Jim Jordan could support today that would break up Google's online advertising monopoly. Every Democrat, every Republican in Congress should get behind this bill. It's a bipartisan bill. It's a compromise bill. It would be a silver bullet to break up Google's online advertising monopoly, which really is the linchpin to all of big tech's monopoly. If you break that up, you're really going to see big tech start to function properly. There's going to be a properly functioning. Remember, the whole point of antitrust 100 years ago is a free market requires a functioning market. And when you have monopolists using their market power to crush competition, to crush competitors, you no longer have a free market. So if you are a free market conservative, you should be all about antitrust law enforcement because you're targeting the bad actors, you're targeting the tumors. You see Facebook calling industry-wide regulation. Of course they are, because those are entry barriers to competitors. Monopolists want regulations, but we don't want regulations. We want law enforcement. And that's why we need to break up big tech with anti-law enforcement.
It's the way you get away from state capitalism. How do people find out more about you, your crusade against big tech, also social media, because you're coming a little hot on Twitter. It makes it worth the ride.
So it's article3project.org, article3project.org. There is a link on there for the War Room Posse that explains all this big tech stuff and the bills and how they can contact their members of Congress. They light them up, 202-224-3121, 202-224-3121, and tell them to support Mike Lee's ad tech bill. But call both of your home state senators and your House of Representative member and tell them to support Mike Lee's ad tech bill. It's important. You can also get me on Twitter, Getter Truth, at Article 3 Project, at Article Number 3 Project, and my personal at MRDDMIA, at MRDDMIA. That's my initials in Des Moines, Iowa. So thank you, Steve, for all you're doing.
By the way, and what a great week with the Silicon Valley Bank. Since the Warren Posse bailed them out, maybe they call Congress and give them a heads up in how angry they are about this entire thing. The entitled nature of the Silicon Valley oligarchs and their minions is pretty shocking. Mike Davis, thank you for taking the time today to come on and join us.
Thank you.
Davis's audience favorite have been pretty busy. Let's go ahead and play. I got Thomas Phillipson from President Trump's administration, one of his chief economic advisors. Let's go ahead and play the cold open.
News out of Europe that sparked today's sell-off and the headlines this afternoon that partially turned things around. CNBC's Hugh Son is here to explain what's going on. Hugh, why does Credit Suisse matter for U.S. depositors, U.S. investors? And is it because incidents like this scare the whole banking sector and scared banks lend less?
Hey, John, there isn't that direct a correlation for U.S. deposit holders. They're actually, is my understanding, really not, wealth management, clients. That's more for the Europeans. If there's a presence in the United States, it's through investment banking. And so if you see the big American banks sell off today, that's because Credit Suisse is a global, financially important institution. It's got relationships with all the big banks, Goldman, JP Morgan, B of A. And so if it starts to teeter and gets closer to an incident, then you're going to see the repercussions pass through to the other big global investment banks.
It's a developing situation. We've had just in the past hour or so, the market came back slightly. I'll say slightly. News that the Swiss National Bank could provide Credit Suisse with liquidity if need be. I guess walk us through what that process could look like and whether that shores up the confidence levels for the bank.
Let me have this. When I hear Swiss National Bank is going to come in and give, which is the central bank of Switzerland, going to come in and give liquidity, that means you're looking at a bank takeover. Later, she talks about UBS and Credit Suisse being put together into a mega bank, a quote-unquote national champion. Thomas Phillipson, you were one of President Trump's senior economic advisors. Is this contagion spreading now to Europe and going to blow back here of this banking crisis, sir?
I mean, we've seen in France and Germany, their banks are now going down 10% today as well, with the Swiss coming down. It was down 20% for a while. It came up after the news that they're going to be rescued. But, I mean, ultimately, I think this is a problem both in the U.S. and in Europe of the instability, essentially, of fractional reserve banking, which is what we have, where the banks basically only have 15 to 20% of deposits on, and that they can liquidate at a given point in time. And then so once you get these problems, you have these instabilities in fractional reserve. Now, the interesting part about that is that we have a new innovation in decentralized finance called crypto, believe it or not, that basically gets rid of the middleman, the bank, the fractional reserves, where it's peer-to-peer lending, right? So it's like email replacing the postal service is essentially what it does. And when you have crypto lending, it peer-to-peer, and the inefficiencies and problems with the middleman gets broken out because there's no middleman anymore. And what's central to all these fractional reserve banks is that they're middlemen between borrowers and lenders. And essentially what crypto as a competitive alternative and a decentralized alternative can achieve, and you see this with Avi and other banks of crypto in crypto markets, they can achieve a lot more stability. Avi has been completely stable through FTX and also the Silicon Valley problem. And the reason the obvious a bank for crypto is stable is because they're commission-based, as opposed to taking deposits, investing them, and then having a mismatch between deposits and investments. So Avi essentially works like
this theoretical discussion, or look, I'm a big believer in crypto as a potential alternative store of value, potentially do transactions. That market's got to develop a little bit, and obviously Bitcoin and things have been inversely related to the drop here. But when you have a mass, I mean, we have $19 trillion, brother, of deposits in banks here, and we've given, and correct me if I'm wrong, is it your belief? And we had J.D. Vance on here yesterday, said he went to the FDIC guys and asked them straight out, have we given it a guarantee on $19 trillion? They kind of dance around it, or even the $5 or $6 trillion of uninsured. With $19 trillion right now, I mean, we have a massive problem that has to be addressed, and it's not going to be addressed by crypto overnight. And they're blaming, quite frankly, Trump. They're blaming you and Trump. They're blaming you and Trump that said, hey, you guys got rid of all the regulations, all the great regulations there with the banking regulations. You eased up, and that's why we have Silicon Valley Bank. That would be they're lying about that, correct?
Yeah, so the White House came out with three arguments which are completely false. One is that it was the deregulation of the mid-sized regional banks to not be as strenuously regulated as the big banks that caused this, or essentially that we don't have enough government involvement in these markets, even though obviously inflation and interest rates hiked the fastest in 40 years is the real problem why SVB got in trouble to start with. So it's a government risk that has caused these failures. It's not, you know, it's not too little government involvement. So the second thing they said, there's no new taxes. Obviously there are when you pay FDIC, when you're mandated to pay FDIC to raise the money necessary for this, that's a tax. And then the third thing they said, this is no bailout of the banks. Obviously it is, because the capital structure is that the depositors go first and then comes the bondholders and shareholders of the bank. So if you take care of the capital or the depositors, then obviously you're taking care of the debt holders and shareholders of the bank. They're obviously much better off when the guys in front of them in the capital structure have been nullified by basically the government.
Now you've got the situation that the Fed's jammed up because the gross overspending led to the inflation. Now you've got the inflation that they got to make a choice: either let the dumpster fire inflation burn, or if they start jacking rates, the entire system, the unrealized losses get worse. How do you think they get you and Navarro and Kudlow and that crowd with President Trump? You had the great years of 19, and even with the CCP virus, the solid year of 20. But you the 19 was a golden year. How do you think the Fed and the administration gets there? I mean, they just gave us a $6.8 trillion budget that has $2.5 trillion of deficit. You got the Fed jammed up in a corner. How do you think they fight their way out of here?
Yeah, the tricky part here, which is the really thing people don't talk about, is that Biden claims to reduce the deficit in 10 years by $3 trillion. That's about, you know, $3 trillion out of $22 trillion predicted by CBO. So it's peanuts, right? It's 10% or whatever. So the question is now, if you have that projected deficit going forward, in addition to adding to the debt that we already have, is that going to be monetized or not? Presumably, it will be partly monetized. And then you're just feeding inflation again, right? That's what we did during COVID. Everything was monetized. The Fed was buying the bonds, the government bonds, and that's why we had a huge spike in money supply in 2020. It was just an enormous shock to increase in the money supply. It was kind of like a step up, and then it stayed up there.
So do you think that game is over though? How do you continue to just have the Fed buy it? I mean, the Fed, how do you continue this? Isn't that, this is my point. The math makes no sense here. You're right. Nobody's 70. All the headlines say cut deficit by $3 trillion. Well, the CPO had it in 19 to 22. That means you're another $20 trillion out of 52. You're $2 trillion interest payments. None of the basic math, nothing makes sense. So are they serious people? This is my point. Do you see, as an economist and one of Trump's senior guys, any real plan by adults to set this thing right?
Of course not. I mean, they cannot be arguing that this is a path to prosperity. I mean, like, the real issue here is that you can't tax your way out of this debt, right? You have to spend. Suppose you wanted to tax your way out of this debt in 10 years, right? Let's say it's currently about 100% the share that's held by the public, 100% of GDP. If you wanted to tax your way out of that debt in 10 years, you would have to raise 10% of GDP in extra revenue per year. That is currently 50% more than we're raising in revenue. Currently, we have about 20% of GDP in government and federal revenue. That's just not going to happen. That's like impossible, right? So you have to reduce spending. You're not going to be able to tax your way out of this debt. And on top of that, when you do that tax increase, massive tax increase, obviously the tax base is going to shrink. People are going to avoid it or stop working, whatever. And so you're not going to get as much revenue as you thought you would initially without changing the tax base. So you are literally forced to cut spending in one way or another. If you're serious about, even if you don't want to get rid of the debt, that's an extreme case. But even if you want to get down to 50% of GDP or 40% of GDP or what have you, there's no way you're going to be able to tax your way out of that without destroying the economy.
Your numbers are amazing. We want you to come back. How do people follow you, particularly social media, any website you've got?
Yeah, Thomas without an H. I spell my name Thomas without an H. I'm Phillipson in my last name. I'm on LinkedIn. I post everything I do in op-eds and TV hits and everything on there.
Are you on Twitter or Getter or Social Truth?
I might go on Twitter now. We'll see. But not.
Thomas, thank you so much. Chairman of the Economic Advisors Council over there for President Trump, and a guy that President Trump thought very highly of. You look at that math and it's they're not serious. And remember, the logic here was the massive overspending when we had aggregate demand back up led to the inflation. The inflation destroyed the bond market, particularly government securities, treasuries. And that's where we're now in a conundrum. And this thing is bad. I don't know how you're going to work your way out of it. Let's get Scott Pressler on here, one of the great patriots and one of the hardest workers. Scott, first off, update on your health. How you doing, sir?
I'm good. I've been out door knocking in the cold here in Wisconsin, so I'm ready to rock.
Please tell me about Wisconsin. I'm very concerned about this race. I keep telling everybody this is the kickoff, really, to 2024, is this race. As you're going door knocking, because you're the best grassroots guy out there. I mean, you're a savage when you get on top of this. How are we doing in Wisconsin?
Well, first, let me discuss the background. So right now, conservatives hold a majority on the Supreme Court in the Wisconsin state, and it's 4 Republicans and 3 Democrats, but 1 Republican is retiring. And on April 4th, we're going to replace that person. So very easily, a 4-3 conservative court, if we are not able to hold this seat, could then flip to 4-3 liberal. And I want to make it clear what's at stake in this election. Gun rights are on the ballot. Hunting rights are on the ballot. School choice is on the ballot. And Steve, I travel the country. I've been over to 30 states. The number one topic that I hear about from voters is they want election integrity. Here in Wisconsin, we actually have voter ID laws. And when you register to vote, you must present a proof of residency. I'm speaking to everyone at home listening right now to the War Room. If we are unable to win this seat on April 4th, electing Justice Daniel Kelly to the Supreme Court, then I promise you the liberals and the Democrats will invalidate on day one voter ID laws in Wisconsin, and they will get rid of proof of residency in Wisconsin. And that is going to make it much more an arduous task of actually winning Wisconsin and winning the White House in 2024. And so we've been writing thousands of postcards, knocking on doors, doing phone calls, registering voters at Marquette University and the University of Wisconsin. And We're going to be doing this for the next 3 weeks on behalf of Justice Daniel Kelly.
Okay. In 2020, I mean, because the laws, although it's got a lot of progressives in Wisconsin, they have some of the tightest voting laws in the country. And they had this thing about signing up for mail-in ballots. But you had these arguments. I mean, Wisconsin was the one that should have flipped the most given the evidence. And we had these, the minority opinion, because one of the judges last second kind of blinked the Republican judges. But if you read the minority opinion of the Supreme Court, it's the best case out there for why the electors should have been sent back for further review. My point is that the Wisconsin Supreme Court is everything. And the 2024 election kicks off on 4 April. If we don't win that, I tell you, and there is no path to the presidency, none, zero. Take it from Stephen K. Bannon, that doesn't go through Wisconsin, Georgia, and Arizona. Full stop, right? These three have got to fall in our column. Scott, do you believe that it'll be much more difficult to win if we lose the Supreme Court seat, sir?
100%. It's going to be much more difficult to win Wisconsin and win the White House if we are not successful in electing Justice Daniel Kelly on April 4th. And please, don't just wait to vote on April 4th. You're not going to like what I have to say, viewers at home, but I've been here in Wisconsin in Waukesha, Ozaukee, Milwaukee, Kenosha. It's been snowing almost every single day. And I promise you, it's probably going to snow on Election Day on April 4th. Go to myvote.wi.gov and vote early. And please, if you want to see more advertising, JustinKelly.com, make a plan to vote.
Okay, Scott, can you hang through? We're going to keep Scott over. Take a short commercial break. Scott Pressler, the best of the best when it comes to grassroots, knocking on doors, getting people out to vote. Reporting from Wisconsin. Short commercial break next.
Battleground with Stephen K. Bannon.
Okay, welcome. Scott Pressler's with us. The reason I asked Scott when he came on about his health, this guy's almost worked himself to death. He's one of the hardest working guys out there. I mean, we've been very honored. Besides our normal everyday contributors, who are, as you know, incredibly hardworking, we had O'Keefe and now Pressler, who are two of the hardest working guys in this business. Scott, I just want to go through, and by the way, Scott has committed. He's going to be in at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. We're going to get him on the morning show, too, for the morning show audience. Scott, I just want you to make the case. Take a minute. And the centrality of Wisconsin, all these other school choice, all this other stuff that's happening at the schools on the grooming side, everything to do with gun rights. There's so many important things that the Supreme Court in, you know, redistricting all of it in Wisconsin are going to hear in the very short term. However, also all the issues with voting, which Wisconsin was central last time, and the Supreme Court will be central to 2024. And that's why I say the season kicks off the early, not even a pregame, you know, on the pregame schedule, on the real schedule is April 4th in Wisconsin. Tell us how important it is and where do we stand? Because I saw some stats that he was 10 down. I think I've seen some polling. He's 5 or 6 down. We only got 3 weeks. What are people to do, Scott, even people outside the state?
Two biggest issues in this race. Number one, medical freedom. In 2020, Justice Daniel Kelly was the deciding vote that stopped Democrat Governor Evers' stay-at-home order. If it weren't for a conservative majority in 2020, then Wisconsin businesses and schools and churches would have continued to have been shut down. If the liberals win on April 4th and another pandemic happens, Wisconsin will have no check and balance against Democrat Governor Evers. Number two, election integrity. This is the single most important issue going into 2024 on this ballot for April 4th. Because if the liberals are able to win, flipping the court from conservative to liberal, they will get rid of voter ID laws here in the state of Wisconsin. They will get rid of proof of residency here in the state of Wisconsin. And mind you, the Supreme Court here in this state ruled recently that unmanned drop boxes are unconstitutional. If we are unable to elect Justice Daniel Kelly on April 4th, then unmanned drop boxes will be ruled as unconstitutional going into the 2024 presidential elections, and you will have drop boxes on every street corner in Milwaukee, in Madison, in Eau Claire, in Green Bay, across the state. It is so crucial that we are getting every single conservative Wisconsin voter out for Justice Daniel Kelly to preserve medical freedom, to preserve election integrity. Now, how can you at home help? Number one, we're writing postcards. You can go to justicedanielkelly.com because I'm hearing from many of you. You say, Scott, I live in Wisconsin. I'm not hearing advertisements. Everything is for his opponent. If you want more advertisements for Justice Daniel Kelly, then I need you to support him financially. I need you to contribute to Justice Daniel Kelly at justicedanielkelly.com. You can also download an application called Early Vote Action. Early Vote Action is an application that you, from the comfort of your home, no matter where you're living in any of the 50 states, can make phone calls on behalf of Justice Daniel Kelly. If you have any questions, please, I'm on every social media platform at Scott Pressler. I will stay up in the middle of the night, answer any of them. This election is so important that I got here on March 5th, and I will be here throughout the election on April 4th. I'm doing everything in my power to secure this election, and I hope that you at home understand the urgency and crucial nature of this election. And you will help me to make sure that we are electing Justice Daniel Kelly to the Wisconsin Supreme Court on April 4th.
Okay, well, everybody, one more time. What is the site to go to that they can make phone calls? Where do they go for that? And then where do they go to get to you?
You can download Early Vote Action, an application. Our website is earlyvoteaction.com. To get to me is at Scott Pressler. Into financially contribute to Justice Daniel Kelly, please go to justicedanielkelly.com. And I look forward to being on your program tomorrow at 11.
Yeah, Scott, you're the guy that's put it on the line. So, and when you say, hey, we need to work here, people line up and put their shoulders to the wheel. So thank you. And we're so grateful that you are out there on the scene. On scene commander, Scott Pressler. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate it. These are the warriors. They're the great ones. I got Boris has got some polling. He's traveling. We're trying to get Boris. But I want to go to Patrick Coffin. Patrick, first off, hope is fuel. I can tell you one thing. The people that are going to speak at the conference have come on the show, and it's blowing people away. I know that I think the conference is this Saturday, right, the 18th. Bishop yep, Strickland, correct. We're still trying to get on, and others. But the people you've put on. So once again, walk through what's the purpose of the conference. We had you on for your first one. It was fantastic, and it was so people were so upset about it, they shut it down. The internet carrier shut it down. What is this conference? What is Hope is Fuel? How do people get there? And particularly, during hard times, you got a free version, and then you got a more inside the ropes version. I want to make sure people know everything about this and how they get there.
Sure. Well, thanks, Steve, for having me on again. HopeIsFuel.com is the wheelhouse for this coming summit, which is Saturday, March 18th, but it's also going to be a movement. It's going to be a live event. It's going to be a community. And we're already planning our second one it's called the Sheepdog Edition. That's going to be for 4th of July, devoted to supporting law enforcement and military. But this one is focused on tips and tactics for mental health strategy, depression, anxiety, sense of despair. You said it with a previous guest, Steve, I was listening to, and you said, this thing is bad. Well, that's kind of a snapshot of how a lot of people all across the religious and political spectrums are feeling. This thing is bad. The news gives us all, scrolling doom. I'm waiting for the murder hornets to come back. You know, bank meltdown, the Chinese balloons, UFOs, Ukraine, Russia, World War II, stock market fears. So if you feel like you've lost some freedom, you're going to feel like you've lost some hope. And that's what the cabal has been trying to do to us, ramping it up since about March 2020. And the shadow of all of that despair is still with us. And so we want to punch back twice as hard. We have a dream team of speakers, 8 speakers from different angles on mental health and attaining a sense of peace and balance. Dr. Leland Stillman, MD, from Florida. He's got a dynamic book out called Dying to Be Free. Basically, big pharma exists to keep us sick. There's very little incentive to offer free tactics to keep you healthy and away from the doctor. Anne Gillies, a very brave psychotherapist from Ontario, Canada, on how to overcome childhood loss and trauma. Dr. Mark McDonald, the child and adolescent psychiatrist from Los Angeles, is going to talk about how to break the grip of fear addiction. Royce White, a good friend of the War Room, is going to talk about being diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder as a former NBA superstar, now podcast host on his own right. Royce and I are going to do an interview with he and I, and then we're going to open it up to a Q&A. And, well, there's Peter Bregan, the conscience of psychiatry, is going to talk about loss of hope as the onset of depression and how you can make yourself well by creating an upward spiral that doesn't have to do with poisoning your brain with psychotropic drugs. Adam Lane Smith on attachment issues, how your relationship with your parents affects your relationship with your spouse and everyone else. And finally, the great, I call him the Gary Cooper of American bishops, just Bishop Joseph Strickland of Tyler, Texas, is going to wrap up Hope is Fear with the final talk. There is a free version. You can go to hopeisfuel.com. We have a premium ticket for only $98. Everyone gets a discount off this one because we want the numbers to be big, because frankly, we want to make a splash on the big one, because my business partner, Ryan, told me last night that within a couple of hours, we had 1,000 more people sign up. So this is hitting a nerve in a good way. I like to think of us as, you know, fighters. Between rounds, they sit in the corner and they get the splash of ice water and they get a pep talk from their coach, from the seconds and so on. A lot of people in your audience are exhausted. Like the people you're having on your show, they're fighting their day in and day out, in season and out, and they need a refresher. They need that cleanser palate cleanser at the battle. So we think Hope is Fuel is what the doctor ordered.
How did you? And it's, by the way, the speakers. Yeah, we know that our. We know our audience is very pumped up about this. There is a free version too, if you don't have, because I know times are tight for people. You got the one that you can pay for. Is there a free version? You can go and just watch the videos. I know you can't participate actually in the give and take of the conference, but there is a option if you can't. How do they get to that option?
They can go there, find everything at the landing page of hopeisfuel.com. They can watch all the talks for free from 8:30 in the morning Pacific until late afternoon.
Why did you pick Hope is Fuel? How did you come up with that? You and your partner. How did you come up with that concept?
Well, I learned from speaking with Ryan that he actually snagged the URL hopeisfuel.com back in about 2014. He wasn't even sure what he was going to do with it. Ryan has been very frank about his own diagnosis with anxiety disorder, clinical depression, clinical burnout, and he's struggled, as many of us have, with the issue of feeling like the darkness is getting darker, and despair is easy to grab onto. And the idea of hope being fuel is kind of a universal idea, that it's a very personal thing. Everyone hopes for different things, but everyone hopes for a good outcome. No one wakes up in the morning and says, you know, how can I make my day worse? They want things to go better. And our news media machine is run by the salesmanship in favor of paranoia. We want to flip that and encourage people to think through the lens of pronoia. Pronoia is the opposite of paranoia. If paranoia is the belief that the world's out to get you, pronoia is the belief that actually the world is in your favor, that things will work out. And that's a very biblical lens. Romans 8:28 says, all things work together for the good for those who love God. Not some things, not most things, all things. So we think this is a ship that needs to be turned around, and fighters on our side certainly need refreshment and encouragement and support. And so all the other details are found at hopeisfuel.com.
Patrick, it's fantastic. Hopefully we can get Bishop Strickland and a couple of others in before the 18th, but I'll be watching it all day. It's just fantastic. You got a who's who, incredibly positive people, serious people, and then you've got people like Royce White to do your talk and discussion with. It can't be better. This is going to be very powerful. I can tell you already from people that saw the speakers, they just couldn't be more excited. So go with God, and we look forward to participating.
All right. Thanks so much, Steve. Godspeed. Appreciate it.
Patrick Coffin, people remember we had the conference a couple of years ago. In the first hour, they tried to take it down, the internet provider. That's how controversial it was. Hope is Fuel. Make sure Grace and Captain Bannon get it up and to put it out on all of our, all for everybody in the chat rooms, everybody that's watching it right now. I want to go to Father Robert McTeague. Father McTeague is one of the best writers out there. This piece you wrote, and then the interview Would you say time is running out? You're one of the more serious people I've met, and we pride ourselves on having serious people on the show. But the title of your piece was A Brief History of Our Annihilation.
Yes.
And you know, I've read your philosophy books. I've read that you're pretty upbeat, you're a pretty positive guy. You're a realist, but you're positive. What is the brief history of our annihilation, and why do you think we're reaching a point, our culture and society is reaching a point of no return, Father?
Well, in summary, we're running out of things to reject and to destroy and to corrupt. I trace an evolution going back from Martin Luther, 1517, rejecting the church. The French Revolution rejects Christ. 19th century Darwin and Marx reject the Creator. In the 50s and 60s, the sexual revolution, we reject sexuality, fertility, marriage. We reject our future in the 70s with the cult of contraception and abortion. If you can't cancel the future, you have to kill it. We reject our past with wokeism, with denying history, pulling down monuments, digging up corpses. We reject our past now with turning, you know, corpses into fertilizer. And now we're rejecting our future by turning our children into sexual consumables. We're rejecting the human body as male or female with transgenderism. Now we're rejecting the human species both with transspeciesism and being a furry, and then also transhumanism. Humanity needs an upgrade from a chip stuck in the back of your cerebral cortex. What we're seeing here is spiritual warfare. This is the spiritual warfare endgame. We've rejected everything God has given us. We've run out of things to reject. What we have left is the nihilistic, narcissistic cannibalism of hell being played out before our eyes.
When you take you go through that list and you see what does it say about us that we continue to reject? You're going back over a 50, 60, 70, 80 year period.
Right,
is this just
right.
The road to perdition? Has been anything to turn it? Walk me through that, because in investment banking they say, well, you don't have to get all the numbers around, but directionally you got to be right. Directionally,
right,
you've scared me because we haven't stood up to any of this so far.
Right. We've been rolled over for a long time. There was a book called The Year of Our Lord, 1943, and it was written by a gentleman, his name escapes me sadly, who said, hey, World War II is coming to an end. The Americans are involved. Let's try to rebuild the world on Christian humanistic principles. People like C.S. Lewis are involved, Jacques Maritain. That got ejected almost immediately. In the West, what used to be known as Christendom, we had peace, prosperity, and no children. That is unprecedented. I think except for pockets of resistance here and there, everyone has been dancing to the tune of the Pied Piper. And what we're seeing now is a failure of Christian communities, a failure of academia as well, and a failure of families. We're going to have to plan for some very hard times, and we have to identify ourselves as planting the seeds for a rebuilding, because the fantasy that we've been living here, that we can live without Christ and get on just fine, that's running out of gas in a hurry.
One of the most powerful, I know Cardinal Zen and then the evangelicals in China, one of the most powerful churches as far as commitment is the underground Catholic Church and the underground evangelicals in under the Chinese Communist Party's dictatorial reign. And they think they approximately there may be 100 million, 200 million. It's Xi's biggest fear. How can it be in a completely dictatorial society, you have a robust, vibrant church? And here in the West, where we have so much abundance, you've seen actually the implosion of not just the church, but the precepts of the Judeo-Christian West.
Well, if you have no experience of physical need, if life is so comfortable that the only time you think about death is when you plan to avoid it, then odds are you're not going to be open to the transcendent. But when you get that boot on the back of your neck, as our poor brothers and sisters do in China, part of you cries out and says, there's got to be more to life than that, just this. And that's a ripe, fruitful area for the gospel to take hold. I think we've just been too comfortable, too dumb, fat, and happy for a very long time. And we have the illusion that we can live comfortably, simply that we can violate the Sixth Commandment with impunity and with no limits to creativity. And so we're just having the party. We're binging on the credit card of Western civilization. We've blown past that limit. And I think we're going to need a very great shock to remind us that this world isn't all that there is.
Father, what are the first steps for people to take? We want to combat this and say, hey, we understand it's a spiritual war. It's all stakes in poker. What's the first steps people can take? What's your recommendation?
Come to Jesus. Very simple. Get baptized. Live a sacramental life. If you're Catholic, go to confession. Read up on what Our Lady of Fatima asked us. And then we've got to start forming small communities. We've got to have pockets of resistance. The reason totalitarianism works is because people are isolated and afraid. This is why dictators hate the church, because we offer a transcendent horizon in worship. We value the dignity of the human individual, and we form communities that are not beholden to the state. So individual conversion and then community connection, that's the first step.
Okay, here's what I want to do. We're going to get all your links up, but walk us through, how do they get to this, the brief history of annihilation? How do people get to this interview you did called at the Turning Point? And then how did they get to all of your writings and social media?
All of my work is at my website, heraldofthegospel.org, heraldofthegospel.org. All of my interviews, all of my podcasts are there. All of my writing is there. The article in question, A Brief History of Our Annihilation, is found in Crisis Magazine. And eventually, all of my recorded preaching going back 10 or 15 years is going to be there, too. That's going to take a little while. And my books
Father,
are there.
Thank you. I know you had changed your schedule to come on today. We really appreciate it. The
glad
piece
to be
was
of
that
service,
powerful, and your interview was that powerful.
Thank you so much.
Robert Matique, it's one of the old school Jesuit, as I would call it, a throwback. We didn't get Boris up for the polling. We're gonna do that tomorrow. We also have, I think Rasmussen's going to join us first thing tomorrow. We've got some shocking polling that's going to come in, and a lot more. Obviously, all the capital markets, the economics. We're going to talk about Ukraine, this whole situation with Ron DeSantis and the Republican establishment. But we've got some blockbuster polling. We're going to start with Rasmussen. You don't want to miss it. Also, Boris is going to be here having some other polling, not just in the presidential race, but also some different states. We're going to break out some states and talk about that issues up there. Okay, we'll see you tomorrow morning, 10 a.m. live, back right here in the Word. See you then.